the name of the values that keep you alive, do not let your vision of man be distorted by the ugly, the cowardly, the mindless, and those who have never achieved his title. Do not lose your knowledge that man's proper estate is an upright posture, an intransigent mind, and a step that travels unlimited roads. Do not let your fire go out, sparked by replacing the spark in the hope the swamps of the approximate are not quite, the not yet, the not at all. The world you desired can be won. It exists. It is real. It is possible. It's yours.
Welcome back to the Crypto Economy Podcast. I'm here again with William Harrison, and we're going to be talking today a little bit about the NRA and Visa, the broader economy and the bonds markets, some tidbits about the Federal Reserve. We're going to be talking about Bitcoin and the anonymous creator and the lawsuit that's currently ongoing. And then we'll touch a little bit on things like media bias and policy as it relates to the current headlines. So, Will, did you want to just get started with the NRA?
Let's go ahead and dive right into the NRA, the controversy going on right now.
All right, so I guess right now what's happened is NRA used to have a Visa credit card for NRA members, and Visa recently severed their ties with the NRA. So just your thoughts quickly on that, Will?
Yeah, I think it's a knee-jerk reaction. You know, this is really amazing what we're seeing in front of our eyes. I mean, it's amazing for two reasons. First, it's a signal that democracy actually does work on an activist level, because this is an insane. I mean, this is a small event in Florida, a very tragic event happened, and the entire country changes its policy outlook based on this. So it's a good signal for democracy, but it's also a bad sign for democracy, because it means that emotion is just so powerful now that you have companies nullifying contracts with other corporations or activist groups, which is what the NRA fundamentally is, right? It's a rights group, just because of one incident that everybody's attributing to this faceless group that just comprises a bunch of people fighting for rights. It's really amazing what's happening. What do you think?
Yeah, and I think it's really only recently where, you know, the reaction has been this quick. And I think it's a lot of times this very outspoken, vocal minority that I think they're increasingly trying to have represented as the majority. They try to make it appear as if you get, you know, 2,000 people in a town hall, then that represents the majority viewpoint of the country, when in fact, you know, that's just not the case. And I think on both sides you have people who are just, I think they aren't being completely honest about how they feel about guns. So I think on one side you have a ton of people, especially reporters, who have never shot a gun. When they're talking about assault weapons, they don't realize, you know, assault weapons or automatic weapons as they're assuming the interpretation of being. They've been banned since, I believe, the 90s. So, you know, there aren't automatic weapons. If you've shot an automatic weapon, you'd know it's really hard to hit anything with an automatic weapon, even. Yeah, it hurts. Yeah, three-shot burst is probably where you want to be, frankly, and that's illegal. Semi-automatic is a very vague term. Almost all rifles are semi-automatic unless they're bolt-action. And bolt-action rifles, you know, you maybe get four shots in there. They're heavy. They're for hunting. And I think people are scared when they see certain weapons that look like they should be in Call of Duty, I guess. But the appearance doesn't matter all that much. Really, what you want to be worried about is the caliber of the round, which is something not a lot of people talk about. And I think on the other side of the issue, the people who are sort of hanging on to their guns, trying to fight against people pushing this gun control narrative. And I think the people who say they want gun control really want a gun ban, which is fine. I mean, they have the right to say so. But I think the people who don't want that and who are fighting against it are really worried about things like a tyrannical government. They aren't willing to openly admit that that's the case, because they've been sort of shamed for thinking that could ever happen again. But it's sort of naive to assume that, you know, tyranny can never occur. And if anything, you want a hedge against people who might want to try to do that, just by having this sort of, you know, standing army ready at any time that really disincentivizes anyone from even trying.
Right, exactly. And what you have here too is you have bullhorns being given to the extremes of both sides, which is a very Alinskyite thing that's happening. And of course, the left has embraced Saul Alinsky since, you know, probably since before he was born, probably. But and it's kind of interesting seeing the right respond to this by having giving Dana Loesch, if you see that saw that video of her, saying that the legacy media loves it when school shootings happen, right? Which is obviously an overstatement, but it's just an emotional argument that captures attention and, you know, increases awareness of her opinion. And so it's interesting seeing both sides play out like this, I think. But just like you said earlier, I think that it's really interesting, like, after the Paddock massacre in Las Vegas, we didn't see a reaction like this. We saw everybody go after bump stocks, which is arguably something that should be banned, in my opinion, because it does make a semi-automatic rifle essentially automatic in the fire rate. But we didn't have this kind of reaction, emotional reaction, where the victims' families became policy experts the next day on CNN. And so seeing that play out is also very interesting. It's something that I think needs to be addressed.
Yeah, I think a lot of people say, I mean, there's a lot of pushback, things, people calling them crisis actors, and they would go on and say it's disgusting that you would use these kids to support your narrative while they're, you know, literally feeding them lines to say at this town hall that they sort of forced upon them. Not, I mean, the time, the turnaround time has become incredibly quick as well. And I think something you sort of touched upon as well is the role that even things like advertisers are playing. So what's scary is that advertisers can really control narratives in the sense that they sort of decide what content can be sponsored, which means it can be given out for free. So, you know, the way a lot of these tech giants have operated is they'll give you a platform for free, and in exchange, they'll advertise on it and make money from that. But that gives advertisers an incredible amount of power over what does and doesn't get distributed as content on the platforms where we get the majority of our media. Like YouTube took down that video, and of the supposed crisis actors, and I think they're trying to ban InfoWars now. But it's like, you know, if you can't just scrub the record of these things, you have to disprove them. So, you know, one thing that was weird is all these articles that came out trying to disprove what was being said, none of them really addressed any of the actual arguments. They never tried to explain why this might have been the case, why there was some confusion. They just came out hard against anyone trying to disseminate information, which I think is dangerous. You want people to be able to spread their ideas freely. And it seems like instead of trying to argue, they're really just trying to push back and shut down any sort of dissent.
Right, exactly. And sunlight is the best disinfectant. And with things like InfoWars, which sometimes, you know, they have a decent amount of true news that they report, but they exaggerate so much to the average person would perceive it as fake news. But the way you respond to that isn't by shutting them down. It's by giving them a fair and equal platform with the rest of the content providers and trusting that the consumer has enough mental capacity to determine what is real and what is false. And right, when you have a faceless corporation deciding that on their own, it not only signals a distrust in their own consumers, but it also drives opposition to the ones that they're highlighting because they feel that the other one's being unfairly targeted, such as InfoWars. You definitely saw that in 2016 with people that supported Trump being, you know, shadow banned on Twitter, you know, silenced on YouTube, had their videos demonetized and shadow banned also on YouTube. When you see that happening, it makes you automatically give credence to somebody that before wouldn't have credence based on their arguments, which is plays back into the fake news and why we need something that's decentralized, like a decentralized authority to manage these relationships.
And that sort of plays into one of the platforms we're developing. We're, you know, trying to address all these issues with demonetization. I think it's been proven that audiences will support the content that they appreciate. And they're, you know, it's sort of just going back to the model that used to be used. It used to be that you would pay for your subscription to the Wall Street Journal. It would show up on your porch every day. That was your way of supporting the content, saying you were appreciative of what was being done. And then it moved to this advertiser model, which I think has been very dangerous because it really caters to clickbait, and you see, you know, a lot of these headlines that are so misleading. And the issue is people are really just reading the headlines. So a lot of people will skim a headline, assume that what the headline says is what the story is actually meant to say. And that's often not the case. Often the headline is just to get your eyes on the article. And after that, they clarify, and it ends up taking a completely different meaning once that's the case.
Exactly. And I'll even go as far as to agree with something that the former President Obama said at a speech one time. You know, I don't agree with the message of his speech, but he did say something about this information wild, wild west highway that we have, where there's just so much information out there that if you were having a political debate with somebody trying to convince him or her of your argument, you could just Google the question that you want. You could frame it any way you want to, and there'd be a headline or 10 headlines supporting your side. You just send that to them. They're not going to read it, and they're just going to believe you. You know, on the flip side, it could also turn that person away and go join the other side just because they think that you don't have enough information. And so it really takes a lot of seriousness and almost dedication on the side of somebody who wants to convince either him or herself or the peers that that some argument has merit. And you really have to spend the time reading these articles in depth and looking in every paragraph and paying attention, not just reading the headline, as you say. And so it's going to take some training of the next generation to be able to get them to avoid the pitfalls that we've experienced as millennials. But I really don't have a lot of faith.
I think the last sort of decade has all been about the centralization of media. So you go to all the same places, you go to your Facebook, and that's where you interact with all of your friends all across the world. You find like-minded people. But I think this next decade is actually going to be about decentralization, where you start to communicate more with the people that live around you. You get their ideas, you try to understand who they are. And I think there are a lot of things that need to be done to make this palatable for things like voting, giving smaller communities more control. When you look at, you know, the federal government, that's the worst way to legislate, because everything you're doing is a one-size-fits-all policy to an incredibly diverse group of people who don't all want to live under the same policy. So by decentralizing, you can give everyone the option to go to the places where they feel the laws in place best represent them. So you can have it, you know, even at the city level, you can have a city where marijuana is perfectly legal. There are shops on every corner, and, you know, next town over, you can have one where that's not the case. And so if you don't like the law when it's passed, but the majority of people do, you can move to the town next door and it's no longer an issue. So you have to give people the option to vote with their feet to a place that represents them better, instead of forcing everyone into a one-size-fits-all system.
Exactly, and it's easy to go vote for somebody who promises to cater your exact package of bills that you want, you know, like a presidential election. It seems more efficient, but over the long run, it gets more costly, and it makes people more frustrated and divides people more when you, instead of being able to choose the issues that matter to you and your locality, you have to you vote them all away to some grand authority so they can fix all your problems, you know, just by getting your vote. And you know, that's why I really think that our system is brilliant. And it's funny that one thing that's really consistent through every administration is that at least half the country embraces federalism. And that's the case now with the left and Democrats, is that they're saying, hold on, we're going to repeal the federal government now, even though over the past 8 years we've given up all of our sovereignty to it. You know, instead of you know, letting them take care of everything, we want to run things ourselves because we believe differently than you, to Mr. President, right? So I think we need to have the full country embrace that going forward. That's clearly the only solution.
If you look at what the federal government is essentially designed to do, it's pooling resources and then having everyone fight over them after the fact, when in reality you can just have a system where all the resources are instead just allocated to your local municipality so that they could be distributed on that level, and you can contribute to your community in that way. You can see the change that your tax dollars are actually affecting. I mean, when the federal government makes a policy, it's rare that we see, you know, the effects on the ground of what's actually occurring as a result. And if we do, we see it 10 years down the line, and we often don't even attribute it to the core cause. But by decentralizing, and I think this brings up something else that you could do essentially is if you were going to have facial ID voting on a blockchain, you could give people the option, especially if you hooked it up with their social security number, you made sure to verify everything beforehand. But, you know, it could be as simple as an app. And within that app, you can see pending legislation, you can give your input, you can propose legislation that you think might be good. So you can crowdsource policy from, you know, the largest community that you can, so that you can get all the best ideas coming to the top instead of just the ideas of, you know, the supposedly smartest people, just 535 members of our localities that we feel have all the ideas, when, you know, they've shown time and time again that really they don't. They're just going back and forth on ideas that have been around for decades, and they don't really seem keen on inventing new ways of doing things.
Yeah, exactly, and which is why we have to push against this new push towards getting rid of the Electoral College and centralizing elections at the federal level. You know, what's really the really positive aspect about the Electoral College is that it enables states to hold their own elections, and so it maintains that trust where you don't trust anybody, as Reagan said, you know, trust but verify. And what that facilitates is allowing states to evolve their own election systems, which is what happened when females gained the right to vote. That actually started in the states, and over time they ratified the amendment because they all agreed, but it had to start with one state. And so if you get one state to implement a blockchain solution for voting, then that could cause a ripple effect, and soon everybody could have trust in the government again, and the process would work.
And I mean, that's exactly how you do a scientific experiment. You'd want one small community with demographics that, you know, you would know from the census, so you understand a good deal about every state. You would want them to test whatever hypothesis you have first, and then having controls, all of the states that are next door to them, you can see, you know, on the ground and based just on the numbers, how this policy did affect things and if it was positive or negative. And then you can go from there based on the data and decide whether it should be more widely applicable. But that's really not what we do. We decide to make these sweeping policy changes at the top level and just hope that they can be well implemented as they trickle down into the state level and city level.
Yep, exactly, yep.
So I also wanted to talk a little bit about sort of where the economy is going. Some stuff about the bond market I think is interesting. And really this is sort of a preface to sort of this idea of a crypto economy. So if there was going to be a move from a lot of fiat services to cryptocurrency services, what would be that push to get it to critical mass? You would need some sort of event that would convince people that cryptocurrencies might actually be safer than whatever fiat currencies they're holding. So this always happens when we have some economic downturns, recessions, depressions. People have historically stockpiled things like gold. Gold is sort of like, you know, the original Bitcoin. It's something that has value across the world, no matter what society you go to. They typically place a good amount of value on gold, all the way back to the Egyptians. So, you know, it's something that has value, but a lot of the value we place on it is just sort of perceived value. It does have a lot of useful applications in things like conducting certain conductivity for certain wiring metals, devices, but not at its current price point. So really it's just, you know, jewelry. But I think it's interesting to keep an eye on things like the bond markets, just to see where the economy might be going. We are sort of in uncharted territory, which I think a lot of people don't realize. You know, we've gone off the gold standard. We've sort of let inflation and debt run amok. And we are essentially banking on the American population holding the debt for the bill that Congress is running up to give us things for free.
Right, exactly. And each time we attempt to address the debt, we just kick the ball down the road. And it's like a snowball that's going down the side of a cliff, right? So I think really what people need to realize is that fiat is a good solution when you have a Keynesian economy, when the government spends money to kick that same ball down the road, but it's not inherently trustworthy. It's Latin for, you know, let it be done. Let it be just because of confidence in public trust. But if you have something like a blockchain technology like Bitcoin, and Bitcoin, of course, is the paramount example that everybody holds up. It's a hallmark of the blockchain technology because of its value accrual. Cryptocurrencies, what they do is they put the trust, instead of holding in public faith, they transfer that into math. And so you have trust in math, which has proved, you know, functioning for centuries and millennia. And I think that's the kind of forward move we need to make in currencies.
Yeah. And if you sort of keep an eye on what's happening as our debt has skyrocketed and we really haven't taken any concrete steps to reduce it. The Chinese, for example, have stopped buying U.S. bonds. And if you look at the Federal Reserve System right now, they're unloading $4 trillion, I believe, in assets. At the same time, the Treasury is doing so. So you can have these snowball effects where these bonds are hitting the markets, and because they are, the interest rates have to go up to entice investors who would otherwise need to be moving over from stocks and equities. So you need to have high interest rates to entice them to move their money over. And you know, typically they will do so because these interest rates are locked in for given periods of time, and they tend to assume that bonds are a safer investment than securities because they assume that the federal government will not go insolvent at any point in time. But when you look at the interest rates they're starting to have to offer for these bonds, at that rate, we're not going to even be able to pay the interest on our debt soon, which means we're going to be...
It's already the fourth biggest federal program, I think.
Yeah,
should be soon, too.
So, I mean, and all these... The reason for a lot of these is just how we haven't been looking at the core causations of the problems that we're having. So we look at the healthcare sector, for example. Well, we have these Medicare systems that are put in place, you know, for good reason. But when you look at the incentives that are attached to them, it starts to make a lot of sense as to why people are not getting healthier, why the biggest causes of death in the United States are actually preventable diseases like heart disease, diabetes. I think one in three Americans has pre-diabetes. And so this can all stem from something like us subsidizing grain and wheat. That can reduce the quality of our of the wheat that we intake. That can cause things like gluten intolerances to occur. When I was in Denmark, a lot of people who probably would have had gluten intolerance over here didn't have it because the quality is simply much higher, and so they don't have all of these, you know, all these tangential effects down the line, which is one of the reasons why their healthcare system isn't so stressed. So people love to talk about, you know, Denmark as the gold standard of healthcare. Well, everyone in Denmark bikes 5 to 6 miles a day to work. You know, these are fit people. They're very healthy people. You know, that's really the issue when, you know, one in three Americans is overweight or obese. And, you know, we're primarily just eating fast food and garbage foods that are terrible for us. You know, there's like one McDonald's and every 10 miles in Denmark, and that's really the only fast food you're going to get. But as it relates to government, you know, the government will subsidize these things, and so they can be offered much more cheaply. And, you know, and then as a result, you have all these health deficiencies. So you'll go in because you have stomach pain and because you're feeling depressed. Well, all those can be caused by certain deficiencies in the gut or the inability to process something like gluten. And then instead of, you know, doing a deep dive, trying to figure out what's going on, they can, you know, hook you up with a prescription to some painkillers and then send you off to a psychiatrist to give you an SSRI. And then you're on the hook forever, plus all of the side effects that those things are going to cause down the line that are then going to need to be addressed again. And all the doctors, they, you know, they get paid or reimbursed based on the visits. So you can go to a psychiatrist and he'll want someone in and out the door every 10 minutes because he's getting $300 every 10 minutes. And, you know, sometimes it's not that much because they have to fight for the reimbursement rates, but it essentially comes down to either paying in cash for someone who's going to give you good quality service for a long period of time, or going somewhere with that accepts, you know, Medicare, where they're going to try and get you in and out as quick as possible, and you're going to leave with a prescription in your hand and probably not going to know what the problem is, but you're just going to put a Band-Aid on it.
Right, and these kind of consequences really demonstrate how delicate a free market system, a capitalist system, really is. Because in a pure capitalist system where you don't have any outside forces acting on the markets, you know, things should respond to human behavior and desires and, you know, market actions that aren't forced by the government. But once you just barely tip that scale, you have these different industries that end up getting subsidized by both the culture and the government, which kind of creates a feedback loop that you see, you know, play out into now we have almost a hospital to grave pipeline or hospital to prison pipeline with these opioid epidemics, because these pharmaceutical companies get subsidized essentially by the government through Medicare, like you said, and you end up overprescribing people and giving them 30 pills of hydrocodone or Oxycontin for, you know, when they really need two basically to recover in a week. And they end up just having these pills lying around the house. They take them for fun. And then next thing you know, they're getting arrested for buying heroin. And so it's something that really needs to change, and that it's only going to come from Congress. So it plays into democratizing legislation as well, because if you have people vote on what truly matters to them, instead of giving all their rights away to somebody who's just going to promise them on one issue, and therefore by giving them the sovereignty for one issue, you throw away all the other issues that are really important to your life that you'd actually like to consider next time you go to the ballot box.
Yeah, yeah. And I think a lot of people love to talk about the opioid epidemic as this sort of, you know, this evil plot by the doctors, and, you know, it's sort of unfortunate, but it's happening just because of some oversights, even if there's foul play. But I think what people have to realize, I mean, I broke my hip when I was a senior in high school. I was on opiates for, you know, 3-4 years. But the problem is, it's much deeper than that. It's a cultural problem. So most of the people abusing these drugs just, you know, they don't have much going on in their life. You know, they don't have a job they enjoy. They're coming home from work exhausted at 10 o'clock. And, you know, they don't have a lot going for them. They don't have a lot of upward mobility. They might not have access to a lot of the opportunities that they might pursue, or they might not have the freedom to pursue them because they're saddled by debt. So you get into a system where you have a car payment and you have your rent payment. And, you know, that's essentially a form of slavery. You're indebted, and so you're forced to work. You can't do what you want to do. And, you know, one of the beautiful things just about the cryptocurrency industry as it stands now is it's giving a lot of people opportunity that they didn't have before. So you're getting all these people who might have invested in cryptocurrencies, you know, 3-4 years ago, and they're retiring, they're doing what they want to do now. You know, they're companies who, you know, I think it's maybe not the best that a lot of these companies in Vietnam, you know, like a company like Robinhood can raise $80 million in an ICO, which is crazy that they never could have come close to that, because there's just not that kind of access to funding in Vietnam. But now that there is, they have opportunities that they might not have had before. So it's all about giving people the opportunity, without many of the trade-offs that you might assume would come with it. I think working for bigger corporations isn't necessarily the way to have a fulfilling life, as a lot of people assume. Just sort of checking the boxes will eventually lead them in that direction.
Right, which I think demonstrates another unfortunate side effect of our system now, is that when the government and the Federal Reserve project these targets for growth, it means that the market has to catch up to that number. It can't decide its own number, really. And so when you have some government institution deciding that number, then people end up getting left behind if they don't meet that. And then if playing back into the opioids, that's their only release, because they've been left behind by society. And so they go into that and they end up becoming dependent on these faceless corporations and their drugs that are really terrible for the health, and they end up going with some street alternative when they can't get a refill. And so I think that, you know, introducing a solution to that with blockchain would be something that is not as far ahead of my alley, I'd say. But
yeah, I mean,
yeah, I'd like to see that happen as well.
It again ties into the fact that, you know, the government in general is, they're reactive. They aren't proactive. So if they were thinking ahead, if they were understanding the changes that were occurring in the economy and how you could reintegrate these people, you probably wouldn't see a lot of these problems. But the issue is that they don't address it until it's too late, and people have found their own way of coping. And, you know, the government has let them down at that point because they haven't created a system that is actually working for everybody. And I think the solution to that isn't making the government too much bigger to make sure that it can, but I think you just need more educated people in those positions who are, you know, maybe not more educated, but at least who follow what's going on. You know, someone who has had experience working in a tech environment, someone who understands where this technology could lead, who at the very least listens to people who are thinking about this. But I think that's not the case, and I think that's unfortunate. And I think people need to sort of be held accountable, because it's really easy to shift the blame to, you know, the Republicans or the Democrats. But the truth is no one's paying attention to this stuff, right? Not on either side. And then, you know, furthermore, they do sort of have this weird relationship with the media where they won't get called out on a lot of things that I think they should. I think the media should be critical of everyone. I don't think they should defend or support anyone. I think they should just objectively report the things that are happening. And I think people are getting less educated on a lot of these topics because all they're hearing are sound bites. They're not getting an in-depth analysis. And that's, you know, that might be how you form an opinion, but it's not really how you learn to think and how to solve the issues.
Yeah, exactly. It's really unfortunate for the media too, that just in general, in essence, it's easier to hate something when it has a face. And so when the media has somebody to target, that it's a lot easier for them to get clicks and, you know, revenue from advertisers. That's really why the media has kind of embraced this motto of attack individualism and conservatism and, you know, almost reason to an extent, and embrace emotion because it sells more. And instead of holding up ideals and ethics as their rallying cry, it's a lot easier to hate something when it has a face on it. And so it's going to be really fascinating to see how, you know, alternative media kind of is, you know, evolving over the next few years, especially with the next election coming up and the one this year too. So I really hope to see that them flourish over this legacy media that's kind of entrapped us in a 60s era idea that we always have something to fight for. We always have somebody that we have to target. There's always new rights to be conquered. When in reality, at some point, things, you know, change from responsibility to license. And that's what the kind of environment is right now, that instead of saying I'm free to make myself happy and to live for happiness, you say, oh, I'm free to do these, to do this kind of drug, or I'm free to have sex with whomever I want, and, you know, the government can take care of my kids. I'll just get paid by the government. That's my freedom. And that whole shift of freedom is something that needs to be reconquered by the alternative media in the upcoming years.
Yeah, I agree. And I think it's also interesting to think about the fact that all the people who are in Congress right now, typically there's about a one generation gap between the people legislating and the people who are sort of coming into age within society. But now you have, you know, a two generation gap at the very least. Most Congress members are well over the age of 60. So you have a lot of people legislating based on a time period and a cultural period of culture that's really passed us on. So, I mean, that I think when you talk about things like drug laws, you know, that's really an idea of the 80s. That's, you know, Nancy Reagan. And I think we need to reexamine that. And I think there is this implicit contract between a citizen and the country he lives in, that he should, you know, he needs to follow the laws in order to live in that country. But, you know, at what point does a citizen get to stand up and reject the laws that he's living under? You know, there aren't a ton of options. It's, you know, you kind of are forced into this contract. It's not that easy to move to another country. And it's, you know, it's hard to find a country that is really aligned with your specific ideals or beliefs. So the easiest thing you can do is give people the freedom to live the way they want, and that gives everyone in society a lot more autonomy, and that'll make everyone a lot happier, I think.
Yeah, and laws are good at guidance, you know, insofar as they're not overly complex and they don't try to tackle issues that can't be tackled by order, right? And the drug issue, I think, is an issue that can't be addressed by preventing it. It has to be attacked from some other. It has to be attacked at its cultural, societal root, which can never be touched by law. And, you know, it's unfortunate to see that over the course of, you know, 30 or 40 years, you know, 20, 30 years, the law has actually achieved the exact opposite of what it originally set out to accomplish in eradicating drug use. And now we have, you know, twice, three times as much drug use, if not more.
Yeah, and I think, ironically, the dark net actually curbed a lot of violence that was associated with drugs. Did. So you were having people who no longer had to go to some, you know, sketchy part of town to get drugs. They could have them mailed right to their door. And so you eliminated this whole culture of violence and drug dealing that might have been occurring just by making it more efficient for people. And, you know, this is not some... I don't think this is a part of the industry that anyone particularly enjoys. I don't think, you know, the drug dealers like that part of it either. You know, it's just something that's sort of come with the territory. But when you can just mail it to somebody, you know, everything is running more efficient. You've expanded your customer base. and, you know, a lot of people were getting drugs straight from the source instead of,
exactly.
You know, who knows where it's been. And that sort of takes us also on to, you know, blockchain and supply chain, which is something, you know, we've been approached for some deals with marijuana supply chain companies, also with diamonds. So doing blockchain to ensure that, you know, you aren't getting blood diamonds. So within the sort of blockchain industry, there are a lot of people looking at it as a means of transparency for where things come from, where they've been, you know, how they get essentially from the supplier to the distributor to your house.
Right. Are you familiar with Budbo, any chance?
No, I'm not actually.
Yeah, I'm not too confident in their embrace of blockchain technology, but it's a good first step, I think, for the legal marijuana industry. You know, I'm still kind of want to wait for that law to be addressed before Bitcoin really embraces, or not Bitcoin, but I guess this one's Ether. But essentially, it's this token that lies on top of Ether, and is a way for manufacturers and suppliers in the marijuana and legal marijuana industry to, you know, communicate and check their databases and make sure that they can't be hacked, and for everything to be in sync and prices to be fixed. So there's that you take a degree of unknowingness or unknowability out of the equation for them and make it more safe and easier to facilitate, you know, transactions in an industry that's targeted by the federal government and only legal in cash. You know, you can't use your credit card or debit card at a you know, buy-off or anything. So I think that, you know, that's a good first step for them. So if you should check them out, and anybody listening to this, go ahead and look at their token. Should be launching soon.
Yeah, no, I think that's another interesting point, is if you look at a lot of these marijuana dispensaries, especially, you know, I'm from California, I'm in LA right now, you'll have armed security guards standing outside because they have so much cash on them that they can get robbed for $1 million over the course of a weekend. So it's become almost like a war zone just because they aren't allowed to accept credit cards and do things sort of more by the book. I think cryptocurrency is actually a great way for them to skirt a lot of those issues that they've been having. But I think it's going to take some time to really standardize it and figure out how things are going to be structured, since it's still very early right now. But within, you know, within the marijuana industry, I'm curious to see how that's going to affect things like the opiate epidemic and just the need for a lot of these anti-anxiety medications like Xanax. Some of those are far worse than even opiates when you look at the withdrawals. So I'm curious if it'll have any impact on things like healthcare spending. And I think it's a good step in the right direction for people who have decided that, you know, that's something that they want to partake in. Some people, I think, have sort of lost faith in the healthcare system because every time they try and go for a fix, they end up worse. And this is something that seems to at least cover up a lot of the symptoms that they might be having. instead of going for something that might be more addictive.
Yeah, one time when I really soured on the government and the leftism movement, really, originally, is that I was reading, obviously, Atlas Shrugged, which this course is going to be motivating to anybody who reads it, but as also the time when Silk Road got shut down. It was really, you know, infuriating to see the government reject such a, you know, good idea to address this drug crisis, that instead of banning it, you make it legal and you secure the chemicals used. Because we're in an age where if you ban LSD, you can create, you know, 500 different lookalikes that, you know, well, you can't just go ban every type of chemical structure that exists. And then you have people that are taking this chemical that was produced with bleach or something in a bathtub, and then they end up, you know, dying by accident because they don't know what's in it. So people are still going to do, you're not addressing the core need to go have release because of our system. You know, you don't address that by putting a wall between the person and his or her release. And so when you make it more secure, it definitely is going to have a huge impact on society. So we're definitely looking forward to seeing that.
Yeah. I think you're always going to have highly motivated people find a way to get what they want. I think it's sort of naive to think that you can entirely prevent that. And I think regulating it is the best way to do it. I think you firstly need to educate people on what they all are. Not all drugs are the same. They have different effects. You know, your brain chemistry can be altered in very different ways. The receptors that they have, I mean, opiates, there are opiate receptors in the brain. There are receptors for cannabis in the brain. You know, we have the brain is actually built for a lot of these things, interestingly enough, and I don't think most people understand neurochemistry really at all. But once you start to read into it and understand, you know, why these things work the way they do and what that tells us about ourselves, about our history, I mean, our ancestors have been using a lot of these plants like peyote and magic mushrooms for decades. And I mean, for example, one of the there was a darknet seller who had an article written about him. He sold liquid magic mushrooms. He was the biggest seller. He was making like $1 million a week or something ridiculous. But he was actually a really charitable person. So he had been sending donations to people that had been affected by airstrikes in Afghanistan. There was one that I think hit a school, and he donated, I think, $25,000 to help with the recovery efforts. So, you know, when you do unleash this free market, you know, it's not that people are inherently selfish, you know, or, you know, these aren't all bad people by any measure. I think a lot of people assume that, you know, a lot of them are very entrepreneurial, actually.
Yeah. They're not all monsters, and it's unfair to criticize people that make a certain type of drug but then give money to other people's and pharmaceutical corporations are doing the same thing. Like, not everybody's a monster.
People don't seem to realize that they made heroin as a safer alternative to morphine. So they actually, you know, created heroin as a pharmaceutical drug. Now it's on the streets and people who are selling it are in jail, but they used to sell it, you know, just exactly the same, in exactly the same form. So, you know, what's different is just our knowledge on how it affects us. And it's strange to assume that a lot of these newer drugs like SSRIs, where there's no way of us knowing how they might affect us, you know, 40 years down the line, because no one who's been on them has even been alive for that long. So we're just sort of making these assumptions that they're safe based primarily on animal testing. And if you've, you know, heard anything about, I think it was some of Brett Weinstein's stuff, talking about, you know, the telomere length in rats and how that can greatly affect its ability to repair critical systems after being subjected to something like a drug trial. And that means that rats can actually repair themselves much more quickly than humans. And that's something we really haven't looked at. So we have, frankly, no idea what a lot of these chemicals are doing to us. And there hasn't been a lot of research except that done by the companies who are selling them as to what these effects are, and even fewer people reading up on any of the research that's out there.
Right. And I'm pretty sure that, you know, neurology is actually the science about which we know the least, that in like the deepest parts of our oceans and then what's beyond the barrier of the Big Bang. So, I mean, it's easy to have confidence in science. And of course, you know, we've had extreme breakthroughs in every field possible. But it's also, you also have to be practical and realistic that, just like you said, you know, these rats that have the telomere lengths that are longer than humans and ability to repair those, that makes some rats incomparable to humans. You can't compare, you know, scientific research on things that are so vastly different. And people don't really realize that, as you were saying, and then are just prone to take things that sound good, and they rarely even look at the side effects, even though they're listed in those commercials that say, you know, your cold will get better, but you might die, or you might be depressed for the rest of your life.
And, yeah, I think people have just, you know, they don't even listen to those warnings anymore, because it's something that you expect to come along with, you know, anything of that nature, but it doesn't mean that those aren't all true and are likely to happen to you should you get on them. But I think maybe we can transition a little bit. I think it might be interesting to talk about sort of what the future of politics and the economy might be, you know, going forward 30 or 50 years from maybe more of a philosophical standpoint. So how we might be able to tailor a lot of our existing ideologies to this technological revolution that we're undergoing, and how we can reconcile the ideas that we have with the ideas that are going to be palatable in the future. So I think there's going to be a future where there's far less scarcity, where people aren't, you know, fighting for basic needs, basic supplies and things like that, where the core tenets of life are supplied. So you have clean air, you have water, well, maybe not that clean, but you've got water, you've got a roof over your head. But I think once you eliminate things like money and income distributions start to level off, just because we're going to have, you know, so much of a surplus, I'm curious how you think society will deal with a lot of those changes.
Yeah, so I think the most important factor is autonomy that's going to be playing out over the next 50 or so years, because the first corporations or groups that get their hands on the ability to truly autonomize every aspect of manufacturing, the first person who gets his hand on that, if it's a corporation, that might be really bad for the economy, because you'll have a couple trillionaires who've provided this autonomous ability to every other industry, every other section of the economy, while everybody else is rendered jobless, which is a transition that over time can be adjusted to, you know, by taking like preventionary precautionary measures. But if it happens overnight, like if, you know, if everybody were to adopt these autonomous 18-wheelers that Tesla is offering, if every company were to adopt that, excuse me, then the most popular job in America would be rendered useless overnight. And that's something that is definitely going to be probably gonna be at the forefront of the economy and politics over the next 30 to 50 years, because, you know, if the government addresses it incorrectly in a way that benefits some corporations over the rest of the population, that could tip the scales even further and, you know, cause a leap that we don't want to see in terms of income inequality. However, if we take a really practical approach to it and make sure that the technology is democratized and that corporations aren't being subsidized unfairly, then I definitely think that the problem that Marx identified in capitalism being alienation from your work can be ameliorated over time, and people will become more able to do their hobbies and do things and pursue passions that they enjoy instead of just being a cog in the wheel of a corporate machine.
Yeah, I mean, looking at AI, it's interesting if you look at how quickly AlphaGo mastered what had taken humans, you know, 2,000 years or some odd time frame to master. I think it was 4 hours. It went from knowing nothing about this game to being the best in the world. And so when you talk about an overnight transition, that's really not out of the picture. Things are moving more quickly than ever, and it's just going to continue to be the case. Culturally, we seem to have mirrored a lot of this sort of speed, and that we're moving very quickly through very complex issues. We're skipping steps. We're just jumping headfirst into the next thing. But there are a lot of people who have a hard time catching up. A lot of people need time to digest some of this information and at least understand what both sides of the argument are, instead of feeling like their thoughts and their ideas have just been glossed over as sort of remnants of the past. And I think an interesting point as far as the corporate model goes, one issue you have now is that if the price of Amazon goes to $1,500, Who is really coming out on top as a result? So it would be one thing if the majority of Americans had Amazon stock, then everyone would be happy. So I think you need to get people more invested in the markets. It's one of the biggest differentiators between people who might be below the poverty level and people who were born into a place where they were in the upper echelon, is that some people just have financial education. So if you don't understand how to invest, you're just living paycheck to paycheck while the bank eats away at your money because of inflation, while they make all the profit by lending it out. If you don't understand a lot of these core concepts, the time value of money, how, you know, not to go in debt, how to make sure that your credit score stays high enough so that you can get good rates on things that you do have to borrow for, like cars and homes. That's where you really see this gap, and that's an education gap, and that's a gap in access to tools and infrastructure. So whereas it used to be the case that you needed a financial advisor, if you wanted, you know, $1 million of your money managed, some guy would come over from, you know, EY or somewhere, and he'd manage your money and he'd make you, you know, 6% a year because you don't know how to do it or you just don't trust yourself to do it. And really all they do is go to a fintech company that makes the software that drops all your money into sort of a basket of different stocks and bonds and ETFs based on your risk tolerance. And that's all they do. They cherry pick a few extra stocks here and there. But I mean, you're paying something like 3% a year on that, at least, probably more. If you're with a hedge fund, you're also paying upwards of, you know, 10, 20, 30% on whatever profits they're making you on top of their management fee. They're not even gonna look at you unless you've got, you know, between $1 and $10 million, depending on where you're going. So there's an entire group of people who just don't have access to at least the basic tools to grow their money into something more as time goes on, instead of letting it be eaten away by inflation as it sits under a mattress or in a bank. And I think there's going to be a big change in that structure as we use scalability to our advantage. So you might not be able to take on someone with less than $1 million at EY, but if you've got an entire world crowdfunding, you know, $20 a piece, and it ends up being $1 million, it doesn't really matter if it's from one person or, you know, 50,000 people. And I think using the scale that the internet has given us, it's going to give a lot more people access to the things that have kept, you know, wealthy people wealthy, which I think is no fault of their own. They're just working within the confines of the system that they arrived here to be a part of. And they just had a little more of a roadmap as to how to navigate it, as opposed to people who were never given that education.
Right, exactly. What I'm really looking forward to see is this is a stock market, exchanges on the stock market, embracing this model where you don't have a fee every time you trade. And that's what I really like about Robinhood, is that they don't have a fee, right? And once that gets embraced by you know, these burgeoning sectors, especially with blockchain, where you don't have a defined, you know, 7.95 rate every time you want to make a transaction. Instead, it's dependent on the amount. Or for, I guess, for Starcoin, like crypto economies developing, you can choose and almost democratize how you pay. That will definitely change a lot of the sectors, especially you know, advertising, entertainment, securities, you know, you can name it. Keep going down the list.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, just because this is the way it's been done, I remember when I was first starting trading, looking at those 7.95 fees, I had to factor that in and say, okay, well, if I have $100, am I good enough to make more than 8% on my $100 as a, you know, 14-year-old kid?
Exactly.
And so that makes a huge difference. You just don't have, you need a lot of money to be able to do well when that's the system you're working within. And I think as we move away from that, it becomes a lot easier for people to sort of, I guess, really just gamble or get their toes wet with whatever they do have to spend that they can risk. And I think alongside that, you're going to see a lot of tools that sort of let people skip the education and go straight to where they want to be. So things like copy trading, where someone can just piggyback on top of someone who knows what they're doing. So if someone, their entire life is just day trading on Forex markets, it's something I used to do all the time. You know, you sit there 20 hours a day sometime and watch the markets and you can make great money. But if that's your entire job, why not let someone else piggyback on top and they'll pay you, you know, a cut of, you know, much cheaper actually than whatever you'd pay a financial advisor. And you get proof of their trading history. You can see how they've done. And then, you know, that's really all you need. Everyone wins. They make more money because they're getting a flat percentage of whatever money they're managing, while you're getting most of the gains that they're helping you accrue.
Exactly. And that also adds more reason to the market instead of making it predominantly emotional. So, you know, if you have somebody who knows what he or she's doing in the market, like you obviously know what you're doing with Forex, I would never want to go and jump in and put in all my life savings and go mess around with something I've never done. So I would have definitely done that if I had the option to do so, because it makes the average person trading more rational and less emotional. So if something happens, a little, you know, flash crash in the market, you're not going to go pull out everything because you know that it's just a temporary thing.
Yeah, and you have a big issue right now with a lot of whales in the market who really, they control the direction. So if you've got, you know, a lot of these exchanges, they have relatively low volume, so it doesn't take much to be a whale. You can have, you know, between $1 and $5 million, and you can essentially decide the direction of the market within that exchange for, you know, short periods of time until it automatically reaches sort of a homeostasis with the other ones. And there's also like arbitraging opportunities that help keep it somewhat stable. But right now there just isn't enough liquidity for that to be the case. So you need to get a lot more people into these environments who might not be willing or able to do so now, because they might not trust themselves, or they might not trust even the people who they're giving their money to for these platforms. So you'll have companies like Poloniex who might freeze withdrawals for a month at a time, and then, you know, your money's just stuck there. That's something they do in Venezuela with ATMs, you know. It's like, and so if you can't trust the companies you're giving your money to, and you also can't trust that they're really working towards your best interests as well. So another thing a company or an exchange like Poloniex will do is they won't refresh the exchange rates before you trade. So you can put in an order and you'll have been watching it for, you know, 20 minutes. And when you hit buy, the price will be what you logged in 20 minutes ago at. And that's because they make a lot of their money just on margin calls from margin trades. So you want to get away from a system where it's purposefully counterintuitive. And that, you know, that happened to someone fairly recently due to the liquidity. He tried to sell, I think it was 100 Bitcoin at a market rate. And someone had put in a buy order for the same amount at $700 instead of $7,000, and the order executed because there was no one else with a buy order at that time.
Oh my gosh.
That guy lost 90% of his investment in one click.
Jeez, and that's also the problem with such a democratized platform, is that there's no way to remedy that, especially with these unregulated. I don't know. I assume Poloniex is regulated at least at some level, but it's such a new technology that you can't really, you know, ensnare every aspect of the trade. Not that that's the solution necessarily, but it's still something that you need to make sure that people who are trading are informed and reasonable and have reason and are able to use it, instead of just trusting some centralized authority to handle everything on their end so they don't have to do any work on their part.
I think it's actually pretty interesting because, you know, it's not that the tools aren't there, that it even hasn't been done before. If you look at the Forex markets, I mean, that this is essentially what cryptocurrency exchanges are. It's a foreign exchange market, and a Forex market is the biggest in the world. They do trillions in volume every day, just currency exchange. That's how we keep all of our currencies liquid That's how we value them against other countries based on economic indicators. So the system has already been sort of figured out, and a lot of these tools are already built within that ecosystem, within that system that most people don't even really know exists. They tentatively know that there must be a way to exchange currencies, but they haven't really had any experience with it. It's mostly in places like London and some in New York. But it's the model is there, so it really shouldn't be that difficult. But I think where you're seeing this sort of awkward convergence is between the financial sector and the tech sectors. So you have a lot of these guys who are very familiar with trading tools and different types of investments and different types of securities and the regulations that go along with them. And then you have a lot of these guys on the tech side who know really nothing about about the financial sector, but they do know,
yeah,
but they do know a lot about the programming aspect and how to make these coins and but sometimes there's also a disconnect with economics. So I think one interesting thing is you look at Bitcoin, where they capped the total distribution very early on, and then essentially whoever the founder was sort of disappeared into the woodwork. There was actually one article recently saying that the self-proclaimed founder or inventor of Bitcoin was sued for $5 billion, so maybe he shouldn't have made that.
I've seen many stories that are purportedly the founder of Bitcoin, right? There's one guy in Australia who was claimed to be hit or claimed to be the founder.
That's the guy who's getting sued right
that's
now.
That's the guy, yeah, because it was for tax evasion?
Yeah, I think so. I think it was because someone's coins got stolen and they sued him as a result. But I think, you know, it works so well because there isn't really someone you can point to who people have to trust. If you look at, you know, people like Vitalik, you know, he's a young kid. I don't think I would necessarily trust him or his platform if I was someone who was older, who didn't understand the stuff. And I think it's illogical to assume that just because he's smart enough to develop this innovative platform, that he understands all of the economics behind it and all of the things that it's going to take for it to have a long-standing history within the current markets. And he's proven that time and time again when he said a lot of things that sort of invalidate the core tenets of the philosophy of his technology. And I think that's one of the things Bitcoin did well. But if you look at a company like Ripple, you know, they can essentially just print currency to their heart's desires. It's, you know, uncapped. They're keeping the price fairly low, but printing a lot of it. So, you know, on the psychological level, people feel like it's cheap. And they see these big swings in appreciation due to the news. And it's also very palatable to banks because it doesn't invalidate their whole business model. So just because you hear a lot about something, I think you want to be careful to assume that that's because the technology is good. I would always be aware of the fact that it might just be because the technology is the most palatable to the people who are trying to preserve the economic models that they've perfected within their own industries. So the banks don't want things to change very much because they're good at working within the system that's in place now.
Right. And building on the blockchain technology part, I'm trying to think of what I was going to say, but it's about the problem with trust in Vitalik is that you're not supposed to have trust in these technological situations, right? You want to trust a decentralized authority comprising many different miners and many different transaction holders and wallet holders, right? So the problem with him is that I think what you're saying is that he's already invalidated two of the core tenets of Ethereum. Is that what it was?
Yeah.
So I think the other CEO of Cryptoconomy, Enrique, and I were talking a few months ago, and he made a joke about a conspiracy that Bitcoin had actually been designed by AI. And, you know, I laughed a bit at that, but I've been thinking that that'd be a great thing to lump into AI's purview is the design of these technologies that require such substantial amounts of trust in these decentralized authorities that could really be manipulated by people that, either don't know what they're doing or are malicious actors trying to persuade the public of something that is not true.
Yeah, I mean, if AI wanted to take over the world, what better place to start than the money supply? Yeah, I think that's really interesting in context. Let me see if there's... Yeah, there was a point I was just thinking about making, but it just slipped. Let's see. Well, you have anything else specifically you wanted to touch on?
Not in this episode, I don't think. I think we pretty much covered everything that we were going to talk about.
Oh, I was going to say one quick point. Okay. What you're talking about with decentralizing mining, I think that's really important as well. That's one of the things we're trying to do is... we're going to be putting out consumer-facing mining hardware so that we can decentralize the mining network. Because right now, if you look at somewhere like China, where they control collectively 70% of the mining power, probably less now that they're shipping it all off to Canada. But that's a huge issue for the network. So if they unplug their units, the network is going to slow down. It's going to become almost useless overnight. So what you want is you want as many people in as many different places that are unaffected by one another to be in control of these networks. And I think going forward, there's going to be more of an understanding as to how important it is to keep these networks somewhat stable, secure. And as hackers, I think, get more acclimated to these currencies, there's going to be more of an emphasis on building out this infrastructure in a way that ensures it isn't susceptible to malfeasance and people trying to take advantage of the fact that this technology is still fairly new and people are still trying to understand it. But I think miners, mining is, it's a beautiful economic system when you look at the way it's developed. They incentivize people to pay for hardware out of their own pocket by giving them a piece of the network that they're supporting every time that they help it run. So, with a one-time investment, it's one of the easiest ways that you can start to accumulate cryptocurrencies, especially a lot of the altcoins that might not be found on a place like Coinbase, where they only offer, four currencies. So one of the easiest ways to get in on the ground floor for a lot of these currencies that aren't listed on the major exchanges is to buy a miner, where you can pretty much mine whatever you please. There are a couple different algorithms to be aware of. Litecoin and Bitcoin will operate a little differently than most of the other ones. That's just essentially because they're running on an older platform that's designed for things that are a little different. But really, no matter what you're mining, at the very least, you're supporting the network.
Yeah, exactly. It's a kind of a simple question to ask. How do I incentivize distributed propagation on this network to where everybody's incentivized more and more as time progresses? It's a really simple idea, but it's hard to find a solution that works over time as more people join, the transaction rate gets higher. So, I think Bitcoin is definitely the exemplar of a gold type of way where it's more valuable over time because it gets harder to mine. And, there's obviously a certain cutoff point. I think it's like 2140 or 21 million coins. So that's definitely one route to go. But I'd like to see two more currencies, like you said, like altcoins coming out that actually facilitate, smaller transaction times as the network grows.
Yeah, exactly. And that's something we're working on as well, is trying to build out a coin with incredibly quick transaction times, because that's a problem really across all payment industries. Is you have settlements, which will take 3 days, and you also have the actual transaction time, which is, how long it actually takes the money to get from point A to point B, not just how fast it takes the information telling you that the money is coming to get from point A to point B. A lot of people don't understand that discrepancy.
Right, exactly. Is once you have such a distributed consensus, for everybody to agree on one, even just one bit of information, it's going to take a long time, especially if you have such a large mining pool and such a large amount of people, requesting transactions.
Yeah. But, as computing power improves, it's just, I think, going to keep getting easier for the model that's been essentially used as sort of a hypothesis to come to fruition in a way that makes sense. I think it started in very early days, and the fact that it's still around now, I think, says a lot, because in the early days, there really was no support. It was entirely in the hands of the community to make sure it worked, and the free market made it work without a hitch, and really after facing down a lot of challenges that most, you know, businesses, companies would not have lived down.
Yep, hopefully it's a free market experiment that continues unhindered.
Yeah, I'm hoping that the governments allow it to progress in sort of a natural way. I think it might not be a bad thing for there to be some regulation in some places, just to at least standardize the playing field, let people know, okay, you know, this is what we're going to do to make sure that we can, you know, collect taxes, and we don't want you to completely go around that the system that we've built, because then we're not going to have tax dollars, and then we're going to essentially lose our power to govern. So I can understand how it's really dangerous to a lot of governments. But I think the industry will stabilize a lot when the people in power finally come to some sort of consensus in saying, you know, this is how we're going to treat this. This is what you're going to need to do to start a company, to start an exchange. You're going to have to, you know, and hopefully it can be a system that's much simpler than what we have now, because one of the reasons it's so attractive to people is that there's not so much of the fluff that we've come to assume is standard practice.
Right, exactly. And this is one area where the U.S. could definitely follow in the footsteps of its northern neighbor, Canada. I think Canada has a really good implementation to make it easy to, I guess, can you explain it? Because you seem to know more about that than I do. Because I remember you showed me this with Canada's website for cryptocurrency.
Yeah, no, Canada has done a really great job as far as being welcoming cryptocurrency companies with sort of open arms. So there are a couple things being done right now. One, they've started listing ICOs as securities for some purposes. So when you have an ICO, you typically have either a utility token or a security token. So utility is something that would be used as a payment mechanism. So, you know, something like Bitcoin or Litecoin, where you're just sending it as more of an asset, whereas a security coin is ICO'd as more of a share in the company. So eventually what you could have is you can have voting rights for every person that owns a coin, which represents some percentage of the company. And you could even pay them, you know, dividends. So it could be like the new equities market, and it can be much easier to start than the traditional IPO route. I think Regulation A in the U.S. has also made it a lot easier, but not as easy. It's really focused on primary markets. But I think the future of companies using ICOs, especially because of how global it is in nature, so it's really easy for people all around the world. We were talking to a company recently, and they got almost all of their ICO funding from South Korea, and they're based in Austin, Texas. So, you know, you can raise money from all around the world. You're not limited by your geographic locale. And, you know, you're not forced to go from one VC to the next, who, you know, you're kind of just at their whims. And a lot of the people at the heads of these VCs have never started a company themselves. And so it's like, oh, so a VC exists because people have money and no ideas, and they're expected to be the people who vet good ideas. Okay.
Right. It'd also be a good answer to the you know, critique that a lot of our friends on the left have about the corporate model these days, where, you know, people are alienated from their labor. So it could be a model for them to develop to enable, I guess, profit sharing among their employees. So if you have an ICO for a company, instead you can have just it available to employees, or you can have it available to the public shareholders, or you know, combination of the two. So instead of the model we have with securities now, where a lot of the profits are distributed among shareholders of dividends, it could go to a model where you can choose to become an employee of a company that gives you its profits over time.
Yeah, and that's sort of the co-op model. So I've heard a lot of people who love this idea. It's an employee-owned company. So, you know, that's how most startups start until you do go public, or you're selling big pieces off to investors. But, you know, you'd much rather keep the equity within the people who you've decided are all working towards the same goal, the same mission, who, you know, you're working side by side with every day. And I think you're going to get a lot of shareholders who are much, much more faithful to your brand if from an early stage they can be a part of it. So you can welcome these people on as, you know, partners instead of just people who are, you know, coming by for a couple days to hold your stock before earnings and sell it off the next day. You're going to have people who are holding a stock more like they used to, the way you would buy Walt Disney stock for someone as a, you know, a birthday present when they were a kid, you know, 50 years ago. Something you kind of stick with, you're part of the process, and you can have, you know, apps where all of the major shareholders of the company can vote on major company actions. So if you're deciding whether or not to enter Asian markets, you can put it out to a vote for your shareholders and, you know, go from there. So that way everyone becomes a part of the process and you actually get the collective wisdom of the people who, you know, have the most to gain and lose as a result of the decisions you're making. So, you know, it's kind of, you don't want to assume that you know everything about everything happening everywhere at any given yeah. time, I guess. Collective wisdom can be, you know, pretty powerful. Even at places like Snapchat, a lot of the hedge funds are the guys giving them some of their most innovative ideas. There's someone who published his letter on LinkedIn. It was almost word for word a lot of the updates that they did. And he was just a major investor, and so he had a lot to gain and lose based on how the company was going to move forward. So,
oh, really? I didn't know that. This newest update for Snapchat?
It was actually the update previous to this one. So,
okay.
But yeah, so I think, you know, that's how you bridge this gap between a culture where businesses are so large because the tech is, you know, getting so far beyond what everyday people can do on their own that you need these large joint efforts, and everyone sort of working together towards these goals. But I think the way you mitigate that is by giving them all ownership and giving them the power to decide the direction of the companies that they are working in. So in that way, you can have a company that functions a lot like a government would, where the people who are going to be most affected by these decisions get to decide. And you have a more centralized group of people whose priorities are at least fairly aligned, whereas you have a lot of hedge funds and institutional investors who will come into companies and just sort of gut them for, you know, whatever reason they might want to short the company. You know, they might be hoping it ends
yeah,
up.
Yeah, or just buy it just to shut it down because it's competition or something like that.
Exactly. Yeah. So you're going to have less of that. And if the company does well, then at least all the people working for the company are going to be doing well as well. So that's going to change some of the problems you might have with income distributions and wealth distributions.
Yeah, and it's also a lot harder to become separated from your job and alienated from the product of your labor if you actually have an active investment in the dividend, or if you have a dividend essentially that comes from your labor. And so I think that'll definitely help people become less dependent on these, you know, psychotropic drugs that help them escape depression because they've been alienated from their labor and seek alternative ways to help remedy that instead of just getting actually a piece of what they're working to be able to contribute and decide the direction of their collective action.
Yeah, I mean, people want to be part of a community, part of a culture. So that's why, you know, at the end of the day, your work friends are going to be the people you spend most of your time with. So you want to join a company whose, you know, mission you believe in. And then at that point, you are a part of either its failure or its success. And so by doing that, you're creating a really powerful, motivating incentive structure that makes sense for everyone. And by providing some liquidity, you can give people the option to leave if they don't like it, sort of like I think it might have been Zappos, where they offered to pay any employee who wanted to leave something like $10,000 to leave. So instead of having to do something like that, you can just give them access to the equity that they've accumulated, you know, instantaneously at any given time, instead of operating on a schedule where people get paid out, you know, once every 2 weeks and they get their bonus at the end of the year. You can have people getting paid out daily. You can have them accumulating, you know, they can be paid in salary, half in securities of the company and half in whatever cryptocurrency they wanted. And then at any time they can cash both those out and go somewhere else. So that way people don't feel trapped in the industry or the job that they have. And you give them the option to leave, but you make them want to stay.
Exactly. Yeah. I think that'd be a good idea as well.
I think that's a good, good place to end things for now.
I agree. Is there anything else you wanted to touch on?
I think we got it all down. Everyone should tune in. We'll be having Peggy Grandy on, who is the former executive assistant for President Reagan, on either Thursday or Friday. And then John Koval, who was the CFO of a hedge fund and the current compliance officer at a fintech firm. He'll be coming on to talk about securities, security settlements, how blockchain can revolutionize parts of the financial services industry. And he's got a lot of interesting insights, and we'll be continuing to bring more people on. Hopefully we'll get our CTO, Will Tran, on soon. He and our CFO helped found CryptoExchange.us after Mt. Gox went insolvent. And Asias runs the Crypto Signal blog on Quora, which is the highest rated cryptocurrency blog on Quora right now. So we've got a lot of interesting people we're hoping to bring in soon, and a lot of developments with the company that we're excited to update you on. So just stay tuned, either on whatever podcast provider you have or cryptoeconomy.news. For more up-to-date information, analysis, articles, and Will will be continuing to update that as we go along here.
Yep, look for some updates soon on cryptoeconomy.news. And with that, I think should be wrap up the day.
Alrighty, great. Thanks, Will. Appreciate it. Yep. And we'll hear back from you guys soon.